I'm Hillary McClure, podcast host at Cybercrime Magazine.
I'm here today with Roger Grimes, data-driven defense evangelist for KnowBefore, the world's first and largest new school security awareness training and simulated phishing provider that helps you manage the ongoing problem of social engineering. To learn more about KnowBefore, visit KnowBefore.com. Roger, welcome back. Great to be speaking with you.
Hillary, and to the legions of people that show up to hear us speak each week.
Yes, yes. Well, we got a great episode for the legions today. And to kick off this week's episode, I guess we can start with a story that was covered by Bleeping Computer, which is about a Wi-Fi protocol flaw that allows attackers to hijack network traffic by tricking access points into leaking network frames in plain text form. And that's just a quick synopsis, of course. But Roger, do you want to take us further through what we know about this story so far?
You know, overall, it's a pretty big story. Wi-Fi, literally anybody to any Wi-Fi network or almost any Wi-Fi network can actually do all kinds of things. Not only read and intercept your data, but actually like inject malware and stuff like that. It's a, and let me say that, you know, I've been in computer security 34, 35 years. When Wi-Fi first came out over two decades ago, we used to kind of see all kinds of attacks like this. I mean, this, it used to be a fairly common occurrence that attackers would figure out a way to abuse the Wi-Fi protocol. And let me say, in similar ways to what this attack is doing, but it just probably been a decade since I've seen any sort of significant attack. Most Wi-Fi attacks today are like attacks against password guessing or something like that. But this one was, or the auto config feature, but this is an interesting attack in that it was a feature I didn't even know was available in Wi-Fi, but apparently the Wi-Fi protocol has this feature that allows you to say, oh, my wireless device is sleeping, so I want you to hold off on the packets. So it's, I didn't know this. You know, I would assume that if someone was trying to transmit something to me wirelessly, that my device and me are just out of luck. But lo and behold, the Wi-Fi protocol designers version, whatever, built in this, you know, subroutine in the protocol where the device could say, hey, I'm going to sleep. And then the Wi-Fi hub will collect those packets. Really strange. So the attack involves basically just artificially, fraudulently telling the Wi-Fi device that, hey, and you have to fake the MAC address, the media access control address. That's at like six hexadecimal digits that's assigned to every network device. But a lot of people don't know you can easily fake that. It's not a, you know, even though the MAC address comes from the hardware, software you can change and tell a network packet that your MAC address is anything you want it to be. So this Wi-Fi attack has the attacker sending a spoofed packet to a Wi-Fi router or access point saying, hey, I'm going to sleep. And then it can use fraudulent packets to kind of wake up that, to tell the access point, hey, I'm waking up. And then able, you know, they're then able to steal it, steal the communication stream or interrupt it, take it over, inject packets, whatever it might be. So that's what it comes from. I think it's a very interesting attack. I think it's the most significant attack against Wi-Fi, at least in a decade. I mean, this is very in line to what we used to see a long time ago. But it's funny. It's just, you know, it's been so long since someone's utterly broken the Wi-Fi protocol. And this one did, and it breaks most Wi-Fi devices. It's, you know, if you know what you're doing, if you have the details of the attack, and I think there's enough details leaked that you can really start to, you know, do things. I think it's only a matter of time till someone makes some automated tool and, you know, puts it on Kali Linux or something like that, where everybody can try it for fun and hijinks. I was surprised that it didn't get more notice, because this is a big, broad attack that works against all kinds of devices. And the article that you mentioned, Cisco said they're responding to close the hole and stuff like that. But, you know, again, I think a really kudos to the researchers that found out about this protocol weakness, and working with vendors to report and get it fixed and that sort of stuff. But really, you know, just a big, big find in the Wi-Fi protocol after it coasting for a decade or more without any significant attacks against it. So, you know, it's funny. I think if there was more people paying attention to it, more hackers paying attention to it, it might be abused more. Probably the only thing that's really saving it from being broadly abused is that it really kind of still requires physical presence. The attacker would have to be within, you know, wireless range of the access point that it's targeting. So it would still take a lot to, let's say, target you. But, you know, if, you know, an advanced attacker and nation state wanted to abuse it, go, hey, I think, you know, I want to, you know, break into Roger's laptop or something like that. This attack would be a perfect way to do that for the people that are paying attention and are sufficiently capable of pulling the attack off.
Very interesting. Well, thank you for taking us through that. And next, in another article, this one from Tech News World, you were cited in this article about the challenges of decentralized IDs, and the article was about verifiable credential solutions. And I guess, can you tell us more about the challenges that you weighed in on, as well as, you know, other thoughts you may have had on the rest of the article?
Yeah. So decentralized ID is this idea that we, each of us, could control our idea, our identity. And to understand a decentralized ID, you may have to know what a centralized ID, which is most of what we use today. You know, when you log into your computer, you're logging in, you know, with a Gmail address, a Microsoft address. Maybe if you're really old, you're logging in with an AOL address or something like that. But, you know, we all have these login names, which many times today are just email addresses. But even when you're using an email address, a lot of the time that's under control of somebody else. Like, again, if you use Gmail, that identity, the life cycle of that ID is really under control of the person that issued it to you. You know, Google, if you're using Gmail, Microsoft, you're using some type of Microsoft account, or AOL, or your company. You know, when I log into my company laptop, I'm using my company's login name or email address and login name. So that's under control of my company. You know, Gmail is under control of Google. My Microsoft accounts are under control of Microsoft, meaning they issue them and they can at any time pull them back. You know, if they feel like you violated the terms of service, they can go, oh, you don't have that anymore. And good luck. It's gone. So the exact opposite of this decentralized ID or DID, and that is the idea that you own and maintain your ID, that you know it's under your control. You control where you're going to use it. You control when you're going to create it, when you're going to use it, where you're going to use it, when you decide to disable it, what, you know, attributes that you might share with a site. So there's, you know, a lot of people have been wanting this decentralized DID for a long time, and it's actually been trying to get, you know, someone's been trying to do it for decades. Microsoft Passport was kind of an attempt. OpenID is probably the most well-known decentralized ID. So if you've ever heard of OpenID, and Microsoft, they called it Card Space for a while. But it kind of died out. OpenID is actually still being used. But this idea that we all need this decentralized identifier ID that we control has been with us for decades. Every time it seems like they're starting to get significant critical mass, it just dies. And again, OpenID is probably the closest that we've ever had to it, and it's still being utilized. It's still not critical mass. Well, the World Wide Web Consortium, WW3.org, they're the ones that kind of set the standards for the internet, at least for the web these days. It used to be, if you wanted to create an internet standard, you would go get what's called a request for comment, RFC, request for comment. And that's where you would create your protocol and get it released. And people in different internet bodies like the engineering task force and stuff would review your RFC. And if enough people liked it, we've kind of become a de facto standard. Well, for the web, that's been taken over by the World Wide Web Consortium. And they actually, a couple of years ago, created a decentralized ID standard, which is actually part of a larger ID standard that they created. It's very web focused. It's very programming focused. But that, you know, so the World Wide Consortium a couple of months ago released kind of like the final version of the first release of decentralized IDs. And I actually wrote an article on it. I read the different protocols. It really, I think, is really well done. You know, my hats are off to the World Wide Consortium for creating this decentralized ID web standard. And again, I can probably send you a link, Hillary, you can post to people so people can read my article, everything you want to know about decentralized IDs. But when I was being reviewed by the reporter for this most recent article that you mentioned, it suddenly hit me that probably the biggest challenge to decentralized ID is that most people don't want them. Most people want centralized control. And it reminded me of all the false promises of decentralized finance and cryptocurrencies and NFTs, you know, that whole metaverse, the, again, cryptocurrencies, metaverse and decentralized finance, there's this undercurrent running through all of them that, hey, it's decentralized. No one person controls it. You know, you control your money and you control your art and you control your finance. But that's actually, through the last couple of years, been proven to be absolute hogwash. And that all of those DeFi solutions and cryptocurrencies, or at least the majority of them, have been more centralized controlled than anything that they, was supposed to replace them. You know, like cryptocurrencies, you know, everybody, it's, you know, going to be owned only by you. Well, it turns out every single cryptocurrency is pretty much ruled by a handful of people, or less than 10 people, certainly less than 1% of the people that are involved in it. So, and then, you know, it comes out that people really many times, you know, even if they could have it decentralized, they don't want to have it decentralized. They want somebody else to manage it. You know, like when the web was first made, when the World Wide Web first came out by Tim Berners-Lee years, you know, decades ago, he envisioned that everybody would be running their own web servers and everything, you know, and it turns out people don't want to do that. It's too complicated. Well, in the same note, people don't really want decentralized IDs. I mean, some do, a lot of people do, but not the majority. The majority of us just want to get on the internet and have fun and do our apps and play games and get our work done. We don't want to have to wrestle with the complexities that it might require if you had your own decentralized ID. So, you know, what I kind of brought out in that article is that, you know, I think one of the biggest challenges, if not the biggest challenges for decentralized ID, is that they're not really going to be decentralized. They're really probably, you know, you're probably still going to pick Microsoft or Google or somebody to, you know, to manage your quote unquote decentralized ID. Now, there's going to be plenty of people, including half my friends, that are going to, you know, run their own decentralized IDs, and they really will control them completely. But the vast majority of us, you know, my kids, my, you know, my mother, my father, my friends, you know, my friends in, you know, outside in the real world, they don't want to manage their IDs. They don't want to have to construct them and figure out the programmatics behind them and whether they're using the right schema. They just want to be able to get on the internet and do their thing. So, you know, when I was responding to that article, I realized that, you know, as neat of a thing that the decentralized IDs are, and I think anybody listening to this broadcast should research decentralized IDs because they're going to play a role in the future of how the internet works. I just don't think it's going to be, I don't know if they're going to be quite the promise that everyone thinks they are, because if history is any indicator, all the past decentralized ID standards really didn't take off. They didn't get critical mass. This new one by the World Wide Web Consortium might end up getting critical mass, but I don't think they're really truly going to be decentralized in the majority of the cases. I think that we're always going to be delighted to have, most of us, most of the world's going to be delighted to have some other third party like Microsoft or Google or Facebook or Twitter or Apple or whatever create the IDs, manage the IDs, take care of all the hard work for us. We just want to do our apps and services and have fun and work and play.
That is true. That's all I want to do. Well, finally, Roger, President Biden's administration announced on Monday of this week, now that we're recording, in which this should go live, a new executive order that would broadly ban U.S. federal agencies from using commercially developed spyware that poses threats to human rights and national security. So, Roger, can you tell us more about this executive order and why human rights defenders and security researchers have been warning us about the risks of commercial spyware for years?
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but there are hundreds of companies around the world that create spyware that anyone can use to spy on us. I mean, it's, you know, and let me say many governments, most law enforcement, there are hundreds of companies. Matter of fact, if you're interested in what the companies are, you can buy a book called The Little Big Black Book of Electronic Surveillance. It used to be called The Little Book of Little Black Book of Electronic Surveillance, but it got to be too big. Now it's several inches thick, but The Little Big Black Book of Electronic Surveillance is a great list of all these companies like Pegasus and stuff that deliver spyware for, you know, anyone. You know, it, a lot of people know about spyware from, you know, spying on potentially cheating spouses and stuff, but really law enforcement buys a lot of it, you know, hardware and software. And these companies advertise, it's kind of, you know, they advertise all over. They show up at different meetings and consortiums, and a lot of governments and law enforcement people have been buying these tools and exploits, you know, 0-day exploits that break into people's cell phones and stuff. I mean, so a really common way that they're used is that a government will want to spy on somebody that they think is adversarial to them. Many times it's reporters. And so they will remotely install a Trojan horse program on their phone. Most people don't know this, but pretty easily your cell phone can be remotely exploited by anyone that has access to these tools. And these companies, again, like Pegasus and others, will say, oh, we only sell them to governments. And it turns out, or we only sell them to friendly governments or ally governments. But it turns out, you know, whenever their customer lists have been leaked, they sell their tools and exploits to literally anyone, you know, good or bad. And maybe I'm probably painting too broad of a brush stroke there. Maybe not everyone, not to terrorists and stuff, but certainly they're not nearly as conservative in who they sell these tools to. So there are these hundreds of companies around the world that make these eavesdropping exploit tools, and all the world's governments, law enforcement, you know, entities, both small and large, buy these products and they use them against us. And I think you actually turned me on to a really great book that was out a year or two ago by Nicole Perroth. Is that it? How it said?
Oh, Perroth. Yeah.
Perroth. Great. I follow her on Twitter all the time. Great lady. She actually did a keynote at our KBeforeCon a year or two ago, although she had COVID and had to do it remote. But she wrote a book, This is How They Tell Me the World Ends, something like that. And great book, but it's a really good introduction to this world of governments buying exploits. And because governments, which have tremendous resources buying exploits, it makes these 0 days just end up costing $100,000 or $1 million. And America used to be the number one buyer of these exploits. Now it's probably Saudi Arabia and stuff, because they will just pay, you know, $2-5 million for a 0-day exploit. But, you know, it's been a problem for a long time where all kinds of governments, and let me say, it's government spying on governments, government spying on adversaries, government spying on all kinds of people, but including really often reporters. And that's where some of this comes from, is that people that we know and like are protesters, are human rights advocacy people. You can read a lot about this on epic.org or EFF.org, electronicfreedomfoundation.org or epic.org. They're two great privacy organizations, and they have a lot of information about all this stuff. Well, I was shocked that Biden made an executive order saying that U.S. Law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies can't buy commercial software, commercial COTS, they call it, commercial off the shelf. So they can't buy from Pegasus anymore. But what's kind of wild is there's probably 100 holes in it. I mean, it says they can't buy commercial software, but it doesn't mean that they can't make their own. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't forbid them from, you know, the way a lot of this happens is you get third party contractors that do it. So I guess I don't know why the executive order was made. I mean, it's kind of, it's good. If you're somebody that cares about privacy, if you're somebody that cares about protecting the rights of journalists and protesters and things like that, you know, this is a win for them in the United States. But why did we need an executive order? Because, you know, it didn't say that they can't use those products. It says they can't buy them from public companies, you know, so I would love for Biden or, you know, and Biden, he's an old man. This wasn't even on his radar of things he needed to worry about before he was president, probably. But, you know, I'd love to talk to the people that decided they needed to do it. How did the pressure form? Why did he sign and push it out? And I would say that probably overall, just knowing the history of the United States and this sort of stuff, it's probably going to be very ineffectual. Meaning that there's just going to be so many ways around it that this doesn't hurt them. You know, I just have this sense that they didn't make this an executive order until they knew that that it didn't matter that they made it an executive order. Certainly what it did not mean was America needs to stop spying on people. I mean, that's not what it means. I mean, that's on the outside, if you didn't know all this history, oh, that's great. He's saying the U.S. government can't spy on us. No, he didn't write that. That's explicitly not in that. You know, it's that they can't buy public software to spy on people. And that's where, I guess, you know, if anyone knows, email me at RogerG@Noble4.com. Why did this get pushed? Whose agenda was it? You know, there's bound to be somebody that it hurt, you know, or something. I reined in some practice or something. Or maybe it was already illegal. They're like, hey, maybe I should make an executive order. We shouldn't keep breaking the law or something. But it has me quite perplexed. I'm delighted to see it. It's a step in the right direction. If you're a privacy advocacy, as I am, I think I'm a very moderate one. But, you know, it was good to see, but very confusing, and doesn't mean that they're not going to spy on us. It just means that they have to use their own coders to do it, I guess.
Work a little harder, I guess. Well, Roger, if anyone gets back to you on that, let me know. Maybe we could talk about it at a later date. But this was a great episode, as always. So thanks so much for taking us through these three stories.
Yeah, and thanks, everybody, for listening to us each week.
Yes, thank you, everyone. I'm Hillary McClure, podcast host at Cybercrime Magazine. Joining me today was Roger Grimes, data-driven defense evangelist for KnowBe4, the world's first and largest new school security awareness training and simulated phishing provider that helps you manage the ongoing problem of social engineering.